Today we're making a transition to study or to talk about man in particular. So if you see on your outline at the top, it says anthropology, better anthropology. That is, anthropology is simply the study of man. And there's a lot to say here, of course, and what needs to be said will have to be said in the next three Sunday school classes. So I'm hoping you've got in front of you the study guide, and we'll see how far we get through that today, and then we'll add more to that next Sunday school class. And then all of this will be wrapped up, Lord willing, all of this will be wrapped up by October 1st. So that will be the last Sunday school class for this particular topic. But this one, obviously, all of them, I would say, are very important considerations. But this is the most important consideration as we're thinking about God as he created man. And so I want to draw your attention to the importance here first. Let me state the thesis of this, as I've been stating the theses of each as I've gone through. So this is what I would state regarding this particular topic, the unique nature. Now, I'm going to use a word that many scientists use here, certainly creation scientists and so forth, and that is exceptionalism. The unique nature or human exceptionalism is better explained by creation ex nihilo than by evolution. And I do believe that strongly. Now, what is the scope? I kind of mentioned that just a moment. Today, we're going to stick particularly to what we call the morphological relationships of man. That is, the origin, thinking about how evolutionists project the origin of man through that evolutionary process. We're going to really talk about similarities and differences between structures. That's really today. And then next Sunday school class, we'll spend a lot more time talking about the exceptional nature of humans regarding the image of God and what does that image confer to man. And so we'll spend more time talking about the spiritual nature of man and how that is unique, obviously unique, not found in any other animal. So that's more probably next Sunday school class. And then, as I said, there's another Sunday school class. So I don't know how far I'm getting today, and I don't know how far I'm getting next week. But the last one will be whatever's left, finish that off. And we'll probably also throw in some issues there related to man and what's currently happening in our time, related to all of these issues of, you know, related to marriage and then the gender issue and all of that stuff kind of thrown in. We'll spend some time there talking about that as well. Well, let me, I think you have some of this there on your outline, and I want to start with Scripture, but I want you to consider this aspect. So I'm trying to, again, point you to the fact that considering humans, this is a whole different thing compared to the other creation. Now, obviously, God created everything, and everything then brings him glory. That is true. Same applies to humans. God created humans for his glory. But there is, of course, something very unique, very different. That is this. If we think about it, and scripturally, of course, this is very prominent. How does God receive glory? And there's really two ways in Scripture. It's over and over. By creation and by redemption. Now, the reason to point that out now is this. Every other organism that God has created glorifies God. God receives that glory through them from his creative process. But it is only man. It is only humans that give God glory through the redemptive process. Only man. And so I state that because that's very important to remember. How does God receive glory? And we might even be so bold to say, yes, God receives glory through his creation, but he actually receives more glory through the redemptive process of man. And so, in a certain way, we are kind of on holy ground here, right? We are talking about man as creature, right? He's been created as a creature, but yet there is this whole redemptive process, salvation, that has to be considered, and that is very, very key and central to our discussion. Now, with that said, we can see both of those here, and I've given you two passages, Revelation 4:11 and Revelation 5:9. In first, Revelation 4:11, we see this whole, right, this is, again, at You say in the book of Revelation, there are those moments in Revelation 4:11 is when those angels were singing, essentially, and this is what is said. Lord, you are worthy. You are worthy, O Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things. That's ex nihilo, right? You created all things, and by your will, they were created and have their being. And that's, right, have their being. We talked about the aseity of God and how God is, right, he is the only self-existing being, and everything else is dependent upon God because he created them. So we see even in that passage, we see that creation ex nihilo, we see the aseity of God. God is worthy. He receives glory from his creation. Now, Revelation 5:9, then we pick up on redemption, very similar. You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe, language, and people and nation. So notice there the redemptive function. With your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language, people and nation. Now say, if we get this wrong, right, if we get man's origin wrong, if we get man's ultimate purpose, particularly as it relates to redemption, then we're gonna misunderstand a lot. We are not then going to understand man in his proper context, certainly as a created being or as a spiritual being. That is, we will neither glorify God in his creation of humans nor by his salvation of humans. There are some, right, and I'm speaking particularly here of those that would call themselves theistic evolutionists. There are some that might just question and say, well, does it really matter how God created humans? Does that really matter after all? Well, I would respond and ask a similar question, related question. I'd say, well, do you want to honor and glorify God appropriately? Do you want to honor him? Do you want to glorify him? And if the answer is yes, then I would say, then it matters. It matters greatly. This is not just one of those topics where you can say, put it on the sideline or say, it really doesn't matter. It's not an issue. We could say God used whatever method he wanted. And now we attribute to God, of course, sovereignty. He is sovereign. He can do whatever he wants. But it does matter how he created. And it does matter the specific ways in which he went about doing that, so that we can ultimately, in the end, we can relate to him appropriately, worship him appropriately, and of course, in matters related to redemption, that is very, very important. So I know all of this is just preliminary, but I really want you to see before we head into this topic that there is something different about considering man. There is something different than considering the other organisms that he created. There is that special degree that we must consider, particularly redemption. Now, this is the verse that kind of be our overarching verse for this next three Sunday school classes, and I will bring it up for each. But I just want to read it before you, not that you, this is very common, common in the sense that you've heard this many times. That's Genesis 1, 26 through 27, as it relates to the creation of humans. Verse 26 says this, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now, what I want to just point out here is there is an example of human exceptionalism. Now, we will note some of these things in more detail, of course. But from that description of creation of man, you do not anywhere. There's nothing here that would even lead you, even remotely, to some sort of evolutionary progress of man. God created man specifically, uniquely, with a unique purpose and function. And all of this is really spelled out for us. So when we're considering man and the origin of man, right, we have it at least already in basic form. God has created man in his image differently, different than any other organism, unique. Now, let me convey a story to you. I'm not sure if you've heard of this because, well, I mean, in the scientific realm and certainly in the biological realm, this name is somewhat common. But if I said the name Oda Benga, anybody recognize that name, Oda Benga? Let me tell you, and this is somewhat of a tragic story. Oda Benga, and it does have, you'll see in the very end, has a connection to Virginia at the end. Oda Benga was a Congolese pygmy. This was in the 1800s, from the Congo. And in the 1800s, the scientific establishment, largely at this point fueled by recent books, Origin of Species from Darwin and others, they had, of course, bought into evolution and applied that to humans and said, well, if it's happened in other organisms, obviously it's also happened in humans. And so this was toward the tail end of, or the beginning of the 1900s. I may have my dates. I didn't write down the dates here. But what they did is they sent a team to the Congo, and the whole purpose was try to find a missing link, right? We're trying to find a missing link between the apes and chimpanzees and so forth, and humans, modern-day humans. And then they wanted to bring back individuals that they thought were missing links and put them on display. Two places that they put them on display was the Bronx Zoo, and then the World's Fair was about that time, and I think in St. Louis, and part of that was happening at the same time. And that was their whole goal. And so they brought this individual and others, but they brought Oda Benga from the Congo, put him on display in the Bronx Zoo, put him in a cage. They were displaying him. This is an example of a missing link. Pretty much the entire scientific community was in support. Prestigious universities, Harvard and so forth, yeah, they were in support. I mean, this is evolution in action. It went very wrong, as you can imagine. They put him in there. People were coming. They were gawking at him. They were making fun of him, throwing things at him. I mean, it turned really bad. And by the way, there's a whole documentary about the life of Oda Benga. It's called Human Zoos. And I invite you, can just go to YouTube if you want. I mean, your eyes will be opened at what was happening at that point in time in the scientific community related to this. But Human Zoos is what it's called. And so they put him on display, and eventually there was a lot of backlash, particularly from the Christian community, you can imagine. There was a lot of backlash, and they wanted him removed. They thought that this is not right. Eventually, they kind of won the day in the sense that he was taken from the zoo. They didn't know what to do with him. And there was a seminary in Lynchburg, Virginia, not Liberty. This was way back. This is a different seminary, which I think actually is still in existence. We always think of Liberty when we think of Lynchburg, but no, this was a different one. And they took him. They took Oda Benga, and they said, we'll take care of him. And I think they did an admirable job. But Oda Benga was very scarred from all of this, and all he wanted to do was return to the Congo at this point. And to make a long story short and tragic story, in the end, he ended up taking his own life in Lynchburg. So that's the connection there. Now, I bring that out just to say world views do have impacts. What is your worldview? And sometimes I tell this to the students. Listen, you say it doesn't mean anything at a certain moment. They may say that. But carry those worldviews out, and they may have drastic consequences. And here, largely the scientific community, we say, what was that? Was, in a sense, scientific racism. And really, if you say human evolution, that sort of racism, in a sense, is endemic to the science itself. Darwin's book on the Origin of Species, if you continue the title, is how the favored races came to be. And when he says favored races, he means favored races of humans. You also probably know that a lot of that in the early 1900s with the eugenics project took place. Some of it took place here in Stanton with the DeJarnett Center and the horrible things that were happening there. And so we're not disconnected from these sorts of things. And so the moment we start to settle back and say, well, does it really matter where humans came from? It does. It does really matter. Because worldviews have consequences. And so that's why it's such an important issue. Now, from that passage, Genesis 1:26, there's a lot of things we can take from that, of course. But I'll just bring your minds to this at this point, some preliminary thoughts. We notice here that man is not created according to its kind, like the other animals. Right? We don't see that terminology. No, it is emphatic. Man is created in the image of God. We might say, very respectfully, in the God image. Man was created differently, in God's image, in the God image, in the God kind. And so that alone tells us there's specialty here. There's unique nature. There's exceptionalism. Now, what do we notice about man? We notice this. Anywhere on the face of this earth today, doesn't matter where you're from, what country, what continent, all humans are in the same species. Any two humans, male and female, could marry and have children. We are in the same species. Genetically, we are the same, identical in that sense, right? There's variations, of course, but we are all of the same species. Now, that is exactly the way God intended it. He created humans in the image of God. His purpose for them was to reproduce after their God kind. In other words, every time that a married couple has children, they are producing image bearers. Image bearers. This is why we take, as Christians, and we should take murder seriously. We should take abortion seriously, because these are image bearers. These are not just animals. These are image bearers. And so, I know at the beginning of this, it's a long introduction, but we see the importance of this topic. By the way, for evolution, that is what I've just said is kind of a surprise. That is that every human on the planet is in the same species, because from their theory, if humans have separated, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years ago from one another, we would think, according to the theory, that there would be other human-like organisms on the planet that are not in the same species. But they are not. They are not. They're all the same. And so that tells us right away that, yes, indeed, what we're looking at is something unique, something special, something intended by God, and we need to consider that strongly. Now, the morphological, that is, when I say morphological, I just mean physical body structures. That's what we're going to focus on today. Evolution would say, as you know, and I've already mentioned it, man in the evolutionary scheme is not unique. Nothing really unique. Only unique in the sense that we have perhaps further evolved than some of the others, but as organisms, really, we're not unique. Man came about just like any other organism by chance, happenstance. You know, there's really no exceptionalism. They say, well, the intelligence, yes, we are more intelligent. We can do more things, but that's just a byproduct of the evolutionary process. That's what they would say. In the end, we are a further evolved animal. That's what we are in the evolutionary sense. Now, let's think biblically, though. If we're thinking about ourselves and other organisms, there are some morphological similarities. There are some similarities between us and other organisms. There's no reason to deny that. Let's think about the apes and the chimpanzees. What they would state as our closest extant, right, currently living extant organism of similarity. We are most similar to chimpanzees and apes and so forth. Do we have similarities, physical similarities with them?
Sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We do. Think about, body structure, and we've talked about homologous structures previously, and how, you know, we've got the legs and the arms and the way that they form to the other portion of our bodies and how they interact, and all of these features, they look very similar to humans. Now, there's no reason to deny that. We don't deny that. We accept that. But here's the question. Does that similarity alone prove common ancestry? Now, that's a question for you, because we've somewhat talked about this with other organisms. So does a similarity, our similarity with other organisms, apes and chimpanzees and so forth, does that prove common ancestry? What's your answer there?
From a Christian point of view, no. From my point of view, no. But from people who are looking at it for evolution, yes.
Okay. Huge. Fair enough. Yes. Good. Any other thoughts?
It doesn't prove it, but it doesn't disprove that they're not.
Yes. Okay. So we say it is a mode of evidence that neither proves nor disproves.
Right.
Yes. Good. Any other thoughts?
Often people, painters and artists and stuff like that, I remember being in school and drawing pictures. You know, you would draw a similar picture because maybe it's a castle or a mountain or something like that, but it looked similar, but it wasn't the same.
Right.
But it was just that hey, I really like the way that looked. Maybe God tried it over here. Maybe God did the same thing. I really like two arms and two hands.
Right.
Worker here.
So you're leading into, right, this could be an explanation, of common ancestry, but also common design, right, common designer. And we've already talked about that, yes?
Well, I think you just said what I was going to say. You can say that they have the same creator.
Yes. Yes, so we got common designer. That is, God used these structures because they work well. And they work well in a chimpanzee, just like they work well in a human. And that's not a surprise to us, I would have to say. That is not a surprise to us. Not at all. In fact, that's what we would, in a sense, expect. So, I've heard, of course, evolutionists say, well, the similarities, the homologies between chimpanzees and apes and so forth, and we'll get to some of the hominin species in just a moment. They think these are the links to humanity. Those are absolute evidence, right? You say knockdown, drag out arguments for the evolution of humans. And we say not so, right? Could be, but that is not what that, common ancestry is not an absolute deduction. Common designer also. Now, I want you to look, I know this is, it's pretty small on your sheet there. I want you to look at that, this is basically the idea for evolutionists, their thoughts related to evolution of humans. And again, we're focusing on physical structures. And I want you to pinpoint several things here. If you're looking there, and I will, so you see at the very top, kind of in the middle at the very top, see where it says H. sapiens, Homo sapiens, that's us. Okay, that evolutionists say modern day humans. Come over kind of right next door. On the right side, see H. neanderthalensis, Homo neanderthalensis. That's what's commonly called the Neanderthals. Now, if you come down from Homo sapiens, kind of straight below that, see where it says H. Homo habilis. Okay, so that's what we'll talk about Homo habilis in just a moment. And then come down directly under Homo neanderthalensis on the right, see where it says Homo erectus. These are the ones I'm about to talk about, because I've got some skull models here I'm going to show you. And then if you come over underneath Homo sapiens, but a little bit over, see the A. africanus. That's Australopithecus africanus. We're going to talk about that one. And then kind of right below that, you see A. afarensis, Australopithecus afarensis. Now, the skull models I have, these are ones that I have at school, so I thought this would be a good time to bring these in. This is a skull model of Australopithecus afarensis. Now, this one, kind of famous in its own right. This is Lucy. If you've heard of Lucy before, this is Lucy. Okay, her skull model, at least, not the rest of her body. And, to be honest, I'm turning it here, and you can see there's quite a bit of significant differences between a human skull and this skull. Now, what are evolutionists and scientists looking at? Well, they're looking at many things. To determine this. They're looking back here, that large hole. Anybody know the name of that large hole? Sometimes scientific names are really hard, and sometimes they're easy. Now this is in Latin. You know it?
No, I was gonna guess.
Okay. This large hole is called the foramen magnum, which means big hole. Okay? That's what it means. Foramen magnum. Now, that is important because the position of this will tell us if this was an upright walker. If the position is back here more, then they're on all fours mostly. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the position of the foramen magnum will kind of tell a lot. It will reveal a lot about that organism. This one, I don't have one for modern humans, but we'll compare with Neanderthal skull in just a moment. The foramen magnum is a little bit closer up here, but not terribly different. These, you kind of see these structures on the side. Those are called the occipital condyles. And they sit, you think about your vertebrae, okay, and at the top you've got what's called the atlas and the axis. And so the atlas is sitting right here. And so you can tell a lot from those occipital condyles too. And then of course we have the dentition. We have the slope of the face, right? The slope of the face will tell us a lot. The brow ridge, you can see this is definitely a unibrow, okay? And so the brow ridge will tell a lot about that organism. And then also the slope of the forehead. Notice this, you got brow ridge, and you really don't have any slope of the forehead. There's no slope here. And then you go back, the cranial capacity, right, which holds the brain, that's often measured. What is the cranial capacity? And you see the cranial capacity here is pretty small in comparison to modern humans. And so all of these things are compared, right? So this is afarensis lucy. This is Australopithecus africanus. I'm going to say, look very similar in a sense. They're not the same, but they look very similar. And by the way, at the end of this, you can come up and look at these and touch these and just be very careful. I've got them on mats up here. But you can see there's some differences. If you look at the foramen magnum, obviously, the position at least is very similar to what we saw with afarensis. This is Homo habilis. And we're going to talk more about Homo habilis in just a moment. See, it looks a little different. Like, compare Africanus, Australopithecus africanus, to Homo habilis, you see. Brain case, much larger. The position, but look, the whole cranial capacity is much greater. The slope of the face is not quite so dramatic. Brow ridge is still pretty strong. And then this is what's called Homo erectus. Now, if we look here, now we're starting to see that the foramen magnum is a little bit closer, means more upright. Does that make sense? Occipital condyles are more pronounced. Still pretty dominant brow ridge, although, right, if you take something like afarensis, right, you can see some differences there. Dentition, we might measure dentition, the slope of the face, the nose. Another thing you can measure is the distance between the nasal cavity and the forehead. And so these are all things that you can measure. This is what's commonly known, right? This one is quite famous. This is Homo neanderthalensis, or Neanderthals. Okay. Now here you can see that the brain case is typically larger. Brow ridge is still pretty strong, and some of these other features, but this is what's called, these are the Neanderthals. Pretty strong occipital condyles, and so forth and so on. Now, again, if you want to come up later and look at those, feel free to do that. All of that, right, and you put these, you measure these things, you put them in a database, and you analyze them. And you try to make relationships, right? Okay. Now, once we have that, what are these? Are they humans? Are they non-humans? That's a question, right? And it is an important question to us, because if some of these are from individuals that were distinctly human, that is, created in the image of God, that's important. And if some of these are not, well, then they're not. They're simply animals, right? Animals with maybe similar features to us, but in the end, just animals. So what we have, looking at these features, are simply that, right? They are morphological features of organisms that once existed. Okay. Now, right there, we can kind of stop. Remember our discussion of biblical cons? When we're looking at this, there is the potential that some of these belong to organisms that no longer are extant. They no longer live on the planet. They did at one point, but they no longer live on the planet. In other words, they're not transitions. They were distinctly a group or kind of organism that existed. God created them, but they were not human. I just want to put that out as a possibility, right? In other words, as evolutionists are trying to show this movement from one type to another type, right? Actually, if you look on the image that I gave you, we can kind of see this clearly. If you look at those to the far left-hand side, to say P, right? That's Paranthropos. That I'm just hypothetically saying this. Maybe that's one biblical kind. All of those in Paranthropos. And there is some genetic variability between that group. Does that make sense? And then if you look at the Australopithecines, that could be another kind. I'm just suggesting this as a hypothetical. There's variability within that group. And then the homo group, which is homo just means human-like. Okay, I'm not saying all of those are human-like. Some of those could not be human-like or human in that sense. But you see there's potential variability there too. Does that make sense? Okay, now, I want to just say this, and then we'll move on from that. But related to the physical structures, there's also what we call genetic similarities, genetic homologies. In other words, what you can do in the scientific realm is you can look at the physical features. But to be honest, often the physical features are very deceptive. They're very deceptive because, you know, you're looking at this structure and that structure, you're trying to compare and you get to, you know, this one's like this here, but it's not like this here. And then different scientists, by the way, in the world of human evolution, this is like the holy grail for them. Every anthropologist is trying to find the links to humans because that is like, that's the most important thing they could do. And so all automatically, that tells you something. They prioritize that. And so often they see things because they're prioritizing it. They see things that they want to see because they want to get to the point of saying, look, this is the missing link. This is it. But careful analysis then will draw you back to be a little bit more cautious. Is that really? And different scientists, different anthropologists will view things different ways. And by the way, there is a war out there in the world of anthropology, even in evolutionary anthropology, because one evolutionary anthropologist will say, I think this is what happened. And another one over here will say, I think this is what happened. And then there's a third and fourth one, I think this is what happened. And they don't agree with each other. See, they're all trying to get the prize, in the sense. Okay.
That's a symptom, though, of what we face in this whole argument. Is
yes.
Looking at the results and trying to determine the origin.
Correct, correct.
So we all have the same evidence, but mm-hmm. there's no way to look back and see what started.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. So there's historical interpretation involved, and not every scientist has the same historical interpretation.
Because it goes from orbit.
Right, right, yes. So the genetic similarities, I would say this is just cyclic. Let me give you an idea. If I were to take two of these and I say, okay, their physical structures are very similar. And I say, well, let's test their genes. Let's see if their genes are very similar. And it turns out that their genes are also very similar. That's not a surprise. That's not a surprise. Because, let's just say, God created us with certain genes that produce certain things like hormones, like insulin. Do other animals, would they have hormones? Would they have insulin? And would they have a pancreas to produce insulin? And in other words, would they have genetic similarities as well? And the answer is yes. So what I'm suggesting is to say that they have physical structures and then to say that they have genetic or physical similarities and then to say there's genetic similarities, that is not a surprise. We would again assume that to be the case. So that's not a knockdown, drag-out argument either. In other words, it's kind of cyclic. Why do they have genetic similarities? Because they have physical similarities. Why do they have physical similarities? Because they have genetic similarities. You see what's going on? And it's just a kind of a cyclic process. Okay. But I would suggest then from there, we're analyzing this. And now this is analyzing chimpanzees with humans. But you've heard this. I know you've heard this. Chimpanzees and humans are 99% the same. And they're saying that from the genetic analysis. Chimpanzees and humans are 99% the same. Are they? That sounds pretty amazing, if you think of it. Well, more tests will tell us and say that phrase, they're 99% the same, has been thrown out everywhere. But in actuality, they've done tests more recently, many, many tests, and some of as low as 70%. But I would say more so, probably somewhere in the 80 percentile. Yes?
But a soul can't be seen as a sign of the lab.
Yes.
Yeah,
a soul. Oh yes. So that there's a whole aspect of this that evolutionists cannot measure, and we'll spend more time talking about that next time. But that you are right. I mean, if you're measuring genetics, if you're measuring physical similarities, right? There's humans are more than just the physical stuff, right? And they can't. There's no way to measure souls, spirit, and all of that. Yes, correct. And that we would say that's really the distinctive, right? In other words, the question for these is not necessarily do they have physical similarities or even genetic similarities. Are they created in the image of God? That's the question. And that's what has to be answered. Okay, getting back to the chimpanzees, humans, 99%, I said maybe as low as 84%. And let me read this to you. Yes? So let me to answer your question, let me read this, and this will give you an idea of how that comes about. Yes, good question. So this is how, I would say this is a type of, for lack of better terms, evolutionary cherry picking. Okay? And I can give you the link to this article if you want the link. Says this, this is just this portion of it. One of the major problems with overall research in the field of comparative genetics, right, comparing the genetics between organism to organism, as we will show, as they show in the paper that they wrote, is that in most studies there is a great deal of preselection applied to the available biological samples and data before the final analysis is undertaken. Only the most promising data from a larger pool is typically extracted for a final analysis. Of course, you can only compare what you know is highly comparable. Otherwise, there is no available sequence comparison in most cases. Biological sequence data often goes through several levels of pre-screening, filtering, and selection before being summarized and discussed. Non-alignable regions and gaps in the sequence alignments are often omitted in the final results of their impact, and their impact is obfuscated. Obfuscated, we don't use that word very often. Confused. What is this saying? If you're comparing the entire genome of humans, that's 3-point-something billion base pairs. If you're comparing the entire genome of a chimpanzee, that's a lot of base pairs. They don't have time to compare everything. So what do? They pre-select several portions, and they only compare those. And by the way, they're pre-selecting ones that they think probably have a similarity to begin with. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so once you get to the end of that process of comparing the pre-selected portions only, guess what? 99% similarity. But did you compare it all? So let me. This is the way I came up. I don't, if this is a bad analogy, let me know later. But I came up with this. What if I said to you, 99% of the homes in Stanton are the same. 99% of the homes in Stanton are the same.
Based on what?
Yeah. And then you read my study and you realize I pre-selected several neighborhoods. And if you look closer, all of the neighborhoods that I pre-selected were built in the 1960s between a 5-year period. And I only looked at those homes and I said they're 99%, let's say Brady Bunch homes, right? They're 99% the same. Well, are those homes perhaps that I pre-selected 99% the same? Maybe. Maybe. Okay. But you see what's going on here. But then if you take Stanton as a whole, are they 99% the same?
What's the criteria?
Right. Okay. So it depends on what you're comparing. Right. I can make statements like that. Oh, 99% the same. Well, look at the details. What homes were I looking? What homes were I measuring? How was I measuring them? And what details were I looking? Was I looking at? Right. That all makes a very important
difference. That's really remarkable. I mean, I used to do data analysis for a living, and if I went to any of my clients or bosses and said, hey, I just threw out the data that doesn't match, and here's what it is.
But they're admitting, they're admitting this is what's happened. which you know, this is important. It's important that we understand this. And so that's how they can throw out a number like that is, and many studies have happened since then. They're saying, no. Even if it was in the 90s, it's not 99%. But I think most scientists are hovering somewhere between the 80th percentile now. Wow. Somewhere in the 80th percentile.
Well, 15% of, you know, 3 trillion pairs is a big number.
Yes, it is. It is. So really, in the end, you say, okay, there's similarities, but they're not as close as anybody has in the past suggested them to be. All right, I've got to close here, our session. So I want to, on morphology related to the skulls, I want to just read some quotes to finalize this here. This is coming from a gigantic tome of a book written. It's called Theistic Evolution, a Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. So in different areas, they came together to really critique theistic evolution. This portion is just on human evolution. There's a whole, I think there's like five chapters of human evolution, but I think this was very important to our discussion here. So back to the skulls as we were talking about them. Let me just read these in conclusion. It says here, an authoritative review in Science Journal, by Bernard Wood and Mark Collard found that Homo habilis, right, so this is Homo habilis, found that Homo habilis differs from Homo, the other Homo, Homo erectus, Homo neanderthalensis, of course, Homo sapiens like ourselves, found that Homo habilis differs from Homo in terms of body size, shape, mode of locomotion, jaws and teeth, developmental patterns, and brain size, and should be reclassified with the Australopithecines. Saying they should be reclassified with these guys here. They're more similar to them. Continuing. Another article in Science similarly notes that habilis matured and moved less like a human and more like an Australopithecine, and had a diet more like Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, than that of Homo erectus. Another paper found postcranial remains of Homo habilis appear to reflect an Australopith-like body. Similarly, over here, Alan Walker and Pat Shipman similarly called habilis more ape-like than Lucy. He's saying, more ape-like than Lucy. More ape-like than this one. You see, there's confusion. A lot of confusion. Depends on who's talking about this and what they're looking at. Rather than representing an intermediate between Lucy and humans, habilis looked very much like an intermediate between the ancestral chimp-like condition and Lucy. And bear with me, just a few more here. I think these are just good, and they say the same. They say what I would try to say, but they say it a lot better. In contrast to the Australopithecines that I've shown you, the two here, the major members of Homo, Homo erectus, and Homo neanderthalensis, these two. So let me start back. The major members of Homo erectus and Neanderthals are very similar to us. Some paleoanthropologists have even classified erectus and Neanderthalensis as members of our own species, Homo sapiens. What are they saying? These two have a lot of similarities with what they would call modern humans. So I'm going to now put these over here. Okay. Continuing. Despite the claims of evolutionary paleoanthropologist and unceasing media hype, by the way, the media hype behind this whole human evolutionary thing is off the wall. As soon as they come out with another supposed missing link, all the media just grabs onto it without even looking at the evidence. It's really remarkable. And then 2 years from then, guess what? It's like you never heard of it, because further study has taken place, and then they realize, oh, this is not what we originally thought it was. But then the media doesn't come back and rebut and say, I'm sorry, we promoted that and now it's not true. You never hear that. Continuing. The fragmented hominin fossil record does not document the evolution of humans from ape-like precursors. While the hominin fossil, hominin just means human-like, hominin fossil record is marked by incomplete and fragmented fossils. Known hominins fall into two separate groups. So what they're saying is, their conclusion is, the known hominid fossils, right, human-like, fall into two groups, ape-like and human-like, with a distinct gap between them. The genus Homo appears in an abrupt non-Darwinian fashion, without evidence of an evolutionary transition from ape-like hominins. Other members of Homo appear very similar to modern humans, and their differences amount to small-scale microevolutionary change, providing no evidence that they were related to non-human-like species. So what are they saying? These three here, ape-like. These three, ape-like. Those two, human-like. Now, we might even say, looking at these, okay, is that a problem? If these were human-like humans, can I definitively say that these are humans?
How would you definitively say that?
Definitively is hard. Now, we say, one thing that we might want to look at is, do they have human-like behaviors? If they have a soul, if they have a spirit, we may be able to see that. Do they bury their dead? Right? I'm just giving you some ideas. Do they act like humans? And the answer to that for these two is, guess what? Yes, they do. Even though they're different, they look a little different. How would we respond to this? Well, I want you to think, as we conclude here, think about all the humans on the face of the earth. Are there differences?
8 billion, yeah.
Are there differences? Sure. Yeah. There are quite a few. Think about height, facial structure. In other words, we notice quickly that there are differences between the morphology of modern-day humans. Why would there not be differences in the morphology of humans thousands of years ago? Why would that not exist? So could these theoretically be humans? I think so. I think so. Neanderthals, you know what they've determined about Neanderthals? This was an isolated group of humans that lived in the Neander Valley of Germany. And because they were so isolated, they kind of have features that are unique to them. That's what we always see in the world of genetics. Why do Ireland and Scotland have so many redheads? Because they were on an island that was geographically isolated from the rest of the population, and those traits kept being passed around from person to person to person, so they took on those characteristics. Why is that not true for humans? Now, I want you to consider that, right? So I'm not saying emphatically, I'm not the scientist, I'm presenting this, but to me it seems very reasonable. These guys here are human, human-like. I'm very comfortable saying those have nothing to do with humans. It's not a transition. Those are ape-like organisms, lived at some point, God created them, yes, and they are largely extinct at this point, but those have nothing to do with a human transition. And I feel very comfortable saying that. Okay, it is 10:17, I'm sorry to keep going, and I know there would be questions. So can I just ask, if you have questions, just to find me at some point, because I want to end. And if you want to come up, I'm going to have to put these away before church service starts. So if you want to look at these, you can come up. Just be careful. They're a little bit heavy, and don't throw them around, please. Okay, let me pray. Thank you, Lord, for this day. Help us to... Lord, you have not asked us to understand all of these details, but we can trust that your word is accurate and true, and especially as it comes to the creation of humans, that you have created humans in your image. Now, when we think about physical structures, Lord, help us to understand that. We understand that you've created, with many humans on the planet today that have variability in their genetic outputs, in the sense that we see things, different heights and weights and structures and so forth. This is variability, Lord. Help us to understand that. But Lord, in the end, that we would put our trust in your word and know that your word is accurate and true. Lord, help us. We do pray. Amen.
Amen. Amen.